Southern Ukraine is bombed for the third consecutive night as Russia threatens vessels in the Black Sea.
The ministry says it will see any incoming vessel as laden with military cargo.
Plus, Swedish submarines offer NATO a new tool in the Baltic Sea.
The waters are rocky and with an average depth of about 60 meters. Too shallow for the submarines that make up most of Russia's fleet and all of the U.S. Navy's fleet.
And later in the program, the Chinese consulate in Odessa was damaged in an attack. Estonia deals with its past, and a conversation about when it might be time for Ukraine and Russia to negotiate an end to the war. Today is Thursday, July 20th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Russia threatens all vessels in the Black Sea. We'll hear about that in just a moment. But first, Russia's bombardment of Ukraine's agriculture and shipping infrastructure continued for a third night as air attacks pounded Ukraine's southern cities, wounding close to 24 people. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma has that story.
Officials say most of the injuries in the overnight attack were in the southern city of Mykolaiv. Another two people were injured in the port city of Odessa, and buildings were damaged in the city center. The attacks come one day after particularly intense Russian bombardments using drones and missiles that damaged critical port infrastructure in the port city, and also come a few days after Russian President Vladimir Putin pulled Moscow out of a wartime deal that allowed Ukraine to send grain to countries facing the threat of hunger. I'm Charles Deledesma.
After withdrawing from the Black Sea Grain Initiative and bombing Ukraine's ports, Russia announced on the Telegraph messaging app that it will view any vessel in parts of the Black Sea as possibly delivering military aid to Ukraine, and therefore as a legitimate target for its own armed forces. The Associated Press's Lisa Dwyer has more.
The White House is warning that the Russian military is preparing for possible attacks on civilian shipping vessels in the Black Sea. That warning comes days after Russia suspended participation in a wartime deal that allowed grain to flow from Ukraine to countries around the world. Since leaving the Black Sea grain deal, Russia has already struck Ukraine's grain export ports in Odessa with missile and drone attacks. The Russian Defense Ministry has declared international waters in northwestern and southeastern parts of the Black Sea temporarily dangerous for shipping. The ministry says it will see any incoming vessel as laden with military cargo. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
As we've heard, Russia has warned that any ships traveling to Ukraine's Black Sea ports will be seen as possibly carrying military cargoes. Matt Miller is a spokesperson for the U.S. State Department.
I will say that Russia continues to use food as a weapon of war. This is the second day in a row we've seen the Russian Federation make threats against ships in international water. Yesterday, the Kremlin spokesperson made implicit, maybe you would even call them explicit threats about ships carrying Ukrainian grain, saying that they could not ensure their safety, which I think everyone can figure out what that means. And today you see them doubling down on these threats. Again, a second day in a row after launching attacks on Odessa, which is the major port for shipping Ukrainian grain. So I think it ought to be quite clear to everyone in the world right now that Russia is using food as a weapon of war, not just against the Ukrainian people, but against all the people in the world, especially the most underdeveloped countries who depend on grain from the region.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. She spoke about the situation in the Black Sea with Kurt Volker. He served as U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine negotiations from 2017 to 2019 and as U.S. Ambassador to NATO from 2008 to 2009.
You know, with Russia putting this post on its Telegram channel, essentially warning that any ship it sees is going to be considered now carrying military cargo. I mean, what do you expect to happen? And is that acceptable?
Well, it is completely unacceptable. Russia has no right to threaten third-party vessels in international waters in the Black Sea. The U.S. Navy, U.S. Marines, and the British and the Dutch, we have all stood for the principle of freedom of navigation for commercial vessels, really since the beginning of the time the U.S. Navy was founded. And for Russia just to come out and say that any vessel that it decides it wants to attack, it's going to attack, that is the equivalent of piracy. And we have to speak up against this.
That's Ambassador Kurt Volker speaking with VOA's Carla Babb. And that conversation came about during Carla's reporting for our next story. It's about Sweden. And now that their membership in NATO is closer to approval after last week's summit in Vilnius, many analysts, particularly those looking at naval operations, are excited about what power Sweden's military can bring to the alliance. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is back, and she explains more about Sweden's military prowess beneath the Baltic Sea.
A symbol of both stealth and strength. Swedish submarines patrol the Baltic Sea waters critical to Russia and NATO. Captain Fredrik Linden is the commander of Sweden's first submarine flotilla.
The Baltic Sea can be easily described with what we call the five seas: confined, confused, contested, congested, and cluttered.
The waters are rocky, and with an average depth of about 60 meters, too shallow for the submarines that make up most of Russia's fleet and all of the U.S. Navy's fleet. Kurt Volker is the former U.S. ambassador to NATO.
The U.S. submarines, we tend to have deep water submarines, large, nuclear powered, very quiet, and often carrying nuclear weapons. And what the Swedes have is something that's more tailored to their own geographic location. The vessels themselves are smaller and suitable for shallower waters, but also the Swedish submariners know these waters.
Swedish submarines have roamed the Baltic for more than 100 years, and the Swedes are more active underwater than any of their Nordic neighbors. Sweden's three advanced Gotland-class submarines will be joined before the turn of the decade by its two next-generation A-26 submarines, which some say are among the most advanced conventional subs ever built. Again, Captain Linden.
So I would say that with five submarines, you could easily constrain the movements of your opponent.
That opponent, Russia. Once Sweden officially joins NATO, the only way to reach St. Petersburg, Russia's second largest city, by sea, will be through the fairly narrow waters controlled by the alliance. Here's former Ambassador Volker.
So it really creates a choke point for access to St. Petersburg, which is strategically very, very important.
And Sweden says its newest subs will have design features even better suited to protect pipelines and other critical seabed infrastructure, an issue highlighted when the Nord Stream gas pipelines were damaged last year. Carla Babb, VOA News.
In one of those stories that's probably better on TV or on the internet than radio, but still worth mentioning, satellite images of a military base southeast of the Belarus capital, Minsk, appear to show increasing activity over recent days. Analysts say this suggests construction of a base for Wagner, the Russian mercenary group. Images captured by Planet Labs on Wednesday show the gradual expansion of structures since the base was first suspected of being used in June. In other Wagner news, a video has appeared apparently showing Yevgeny Prigozhin, the group's leader. Ben Thomas reports.
That's purportedly Yevgeny Prigozhin welcoming his troops to Belarus in a video put out by his Wagner group on a messaging app. It would be his first such appearance since last month's short-lived rebellion, which he maintained was aimed at ousting incompetent Russian military leaders. The blurry video, the authenticity of which could not be immediately verified, shows him in silhouette at dusk at a field camp, telling his troops they will train Belarus's military before deploying to Africa. He repeats his criticism of the conduct of the fighting in Ukraine, saying what's happening at the front line right now is a disgrace that we should not be part of. And he suggests Wagner forces could return to Ukraine, in his words, when we are sure we won't be forced to put ourselves and our experience to shame. I'm Ben Thomas.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Estonia is asking hard questions about its past. We'll learn more in a few minutes. Now, for more details on the attacks in Ukraine's south, I'm joined by our reporter in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova.
Yeah, another really bad night for Odessa and Mykolaiv. Unfortunately, third night in a row, these two cities and outskirts of the cities are the main target for Russian forces and Russian shelling.
And what kind of damage was done?
Well, in terms of the damage, we know that in Odessa, there are damages in the city. For instance, the damage of the children preschool, the damage of the consulate of China in the central part of the city.
So the consulate of China in Odessa, has that been confirmed that was hit?
This was confirmed. Yes, this was confirmed just during the day, and this was confirmed by the Odessa local authorities.
Any reaction from the authorities in Kyiv on the damage to a Chinese consulate?
Well, not yet that we have actually that we can actually report on, nothing separate, but it could be that it will come later on.
And have you heard from the Chinese authorities?
Similarly, not yet.
Okay. Well, back to our conversation about the destruction in southern Ukraine. We spoke earlier how this is being seen as an attempt by Russia by destroying the ports and the shipping infrastructure to make it hard for Ukraine to ship its grain to other parts of the world. This, of course, after the Ukrainian grain deal, the Black Sea Grain Initiative, fell apart. And now Russia is saying that they can attack any ships in the Black Sea heading to Ukrainian ports. What's the reaction been there?
This is something that, unfortunately, Russian authorities decided to do to stop this deal and to put such conditions. Today, Ukrainian authorities as well get out with an official statement, basically similar statement that starting from tomorrow, all vessels which are heading to Russian ports or Ukrainian ports which are currently occupied by Russia would also be considered as a target, and they would be considered as vessels that could possibly carry military support.
So it seems to be increasing the tensions instead of trying to cool things down. Anna, changing gears for a quick second, yesterday... it was a busy day for you in the afternoon. Samantha Power, the administrator for the USAID, was in town. Can you tell us what she said?
Ms. Power was actually also visiting Odessa just day before yesterday, and she was also witnessing all these consequences of Russian attacks, and she was... dealing with one of the main topics that she was talking about was actually the grain issue, but also additionally she was meeting Ukrainian officials. She was meeting President Zelensky. She visited Bucha and Irpin. She said that she was presented with Ukrainian IT technologies, which will help soon people and to renovate and to rebuild, and also preparation of Ukraine for the upcoming winter. So energy question was one of the also main topics she discussed with Ukrainian authorities.
And we'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
And as we just heard, Samantha Power, the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, was in Kyiv on Wednesday, and Anna Chernikova was there.
Response of the international community, considering what's happening with the grain deal right now?
Well, I think countries and leaders near and far should be condemning publicly the decision to withdraw from an initiative that was all about getting food out of Ukraine to the rest of the world. Two-thirds of the wheat that came out of the Black Sea Grain Initiative export channel went to developing countries. That is an enormous amount of wheat, and I saw firsthand in places like Somalia, Kenya and Lebanon over the course of the last year, just how dependent those economies are on the import of Ukrainian wheat. So, you know, this is not a time for countries to stand back and lament this development. This is a chance for them to come out publicly, or better yet, engage Russian diplomats on the cost of this decision for global food prices.
That was Samantha Power in Kyiv on Wednesday evening. And among the most vocal critics of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Estonia this year declared Moscow a state sponsor of terrorism and expelled the Russian ambassador. Now, the threat of Russian aggression is prompting Estonia to revisit its Soviet history and teach young people about the dangers of totalitarianism. Marcus Harton narrates this report from Ricardo Marquina in the Estonian capital, Tallinn.
The typical cell was 16 bunks.
Heiki Ahonen walks the corridors of the Potere prison, where thousands of political dissidents were held during Estonia's Soviet years. He spent almost 5 years of his life there, accused of anti-communist agitation. Now a museum depicting the abuses of the Soviet regime, Potere welcomes visitors with a sign that says, "Communism is a prison." Its aim is to warn new generations about life under a totalitarian regime. For Ahonen, the memory is still fresh.
I think the most distinctive thing is a smell of dirt, sweat, blood, and fear. Soviet system was just humiliating, and I didn't like it, and I didn't want in future that my children once are going to think that I was with this system.
The generation that lived through communist repression does not want this past to be forgotten, especially now with Russia's invasion of Ukraine reviving that threat. For Milis Marupu, a historian behind the Victims of Communism Memorial in Tallinn, the behavior of present-day Russia is similar to that of its totalitarian past.
Today's Russia are taking different parts from his history, from Russian Empire period, from Soviet period, to build up a new picture, and through this new picture to find an excuse to dictate his wishes to his neighbors.
Estonia has been independent since the 1991 collapse of the Soviet Union. While some Estonians consider the Soviet past a time of temporary occupation that should be treated separately from the nation's history, others say it should not be ignored. Uku Lember is director of the School of Humanities at Tallinn University.
It is tricky because this period is quite close to us. And in some ways it is very different. And in some ways it is quite similar too. People currently in Tallinn often live in the houses that were built in the Soviet period. We need to tackle it as our own past as well. It doesn't help us if we only say that it's a foreign past.
Estonia has been one of the most vocal European nations against Russia's invasion of Ukraine, declaring Moscow a state sponsor of terrorism in 2022 and expelling the Russian ambassador the following year. As Estonian leaders see it, if younger people are to understand what is happening in Ukraine, they must learn about Estonia's Soviet past. Kristina Kallas is Estonia's Minister of Education.
And I think we need to pay attention to this because it's important that the young generation, whether they are Russian speakers and Estonian speakers in Estonia, can interpret what Russia is doing right now in Ukraine. Because the interpretation is important. What does it mean?
Estonia shares a 300-kilometer border and centuries of turbulent history with Russia. With the war in Ukraine still raging, many Estonians fear Moscow may be trying to resuscitate the Soviet past. For Ricardo Marquina in Tallinn, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
In a recent Fox News interview, former President Donald Trump said he could end the war in 24 hours by forcing Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to negotiate with Russia. And as Kyiv's counteroffensive is moving slower than many predicted, some analysts are talking about a stalemate on the battlefield and a long, drawn-out conflict. All of this begs the question, is it time? Or when will it be time for Zelensky to negotiate with Putin? My colleague Steve Miller spoke with former U.S. ambassador and current adjunct senior fellow at the Rand Corporation, William Courtney.
So usually negotiations will take place when both sides have reached the point of exhaustion. That was the case, for example, in Bosnia in the mid-1990s. But we're not at that point yet. The Russians are still marshaling large numbers of forces. For example, they're apparently massing 100,000 forces close to Kharkiv. The Ukrainians still seem very strongly motivated to fight. And the battlefield dynamics really have kind of moved in the Ukrainian direction, not decisively, but they're still moving in the Ukrainian direction. So there won't really be any real negotiation anytime soon under these circumstances. And for the U.S., for example, or the West to pressure Ukraine to negotiate under circumstances when the Russian military leadership and perhaps the Kremlin are in turmoil would be a foolish effort.
But what are some of the obstacles you foresee in getting to a point when discussions do take place, given that Russia went into Crimea, annexed it in 2014? There's been Russian sympathizers and pro-Russian groups in the Donbas and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine since that time as well, and are fairly entrenched in both areas. So with the Ukrainian position that it wants all of Russian occupied territory given back to Ukraine, what are some of the biggest challenges that you see moving forward?
The two biggest challenges are that neither Russia nor Ukraine shows an interest in negotiating at present.
You know, what's the tipping point?
It's a war of attrition right at this moment. But, you know, last September, for example, when Ukrainian forces swept through Kharkiv Oblast, you know, that was not a war of attrition. That was a more active engagement, if you will. So right at the moment, we see some attrition, but the Ukrainians have not brought forward the main brigades that the West has trained for more decisive action. So we're seeing more skirmishing now. It's not just skirmishing, not just probing attacks, but we're not seeing the main Ukrainian forces engaged. So it's a bit premature to say that this is settled into a war of attrition.
That's a fair assessment. So, I mean, so do I understand this right? Is that because these are more skirmishes and the full counteroffensive may or may not have really gotten underway because of the Western trained forces not being necessarily inherently involved in the fighting, that until some major battles, some major fighting takes place that really tips the conflict in one way or the other, that there's just not going to be any kind of discussions because neither side sees value in it?
So it's not just a matter of engaging the main forces. Even after they're engaged, and we don't know how that's going to come out, you know, neither Russia nor Ukraine may be willing to negotiate. So you really can't have a negotiation until both sides are, you know, to some extent willing to negotiate. And the West is certainly not going to pressure Ukraine and undermine Ukrainian confidence in Western support by pressuring Ukraine to negotiate at a time when Russian forces are really on their back foot.
Ambassador William Courtney is an adjunct senior fellow with the RAND Corporation. Ambassador, thank you very much for your insight today.
You're quite welcome, Steve.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media, be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.